The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Tuesday, April the 1st, 2008. This is Guardian Daily. I'm Tony Adams. In today's programme, how one part of the fight against global warming is being made a mockery of thanks to a splash and dash scam.
The European companies are fighting back themselves because they're actually shipping their fuel over to America, qualifying for the subsidy by adding a little drop of American fuel in and shipping it back across the Atlantic and selling it again in Europe.
Zimbabwe's political opposition say they've achieved an overwhelming victory in Saturday's election. So just how long can Robert Mugabe stay silent about the result?
If, of course, the vote is being manipulated, it will be quite clear. This is not just tinkering with a few numbers. Whole constituencies' outcomes are going to have to be reversed.
Are Britain's judges the biggest obstruction to increasing the conviction rate for rape? Plus, Les Dennis talking about his marriage breakup and why everyone gets game show Tourette's around him. But before all that, Bill Overton has a roundup of the latest news headlines and a look at today's papers.
International pressures growing on the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission to announce the final result of the presidential election. Robert Mugabe, who's held power in Zimbabwe for 28 years, is believed to have been defeated by the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. However, delays in announcing the result are fueling rumours that Mugabe intends to remain in place as president, whatever the result. A House of Lords committee has found no evidence to support the government's claim that a high level of net immigration has significantly benefited Britain's economy. The cross-party group of peers suggests an explicit and reasoned limit should be set for immigration from outside the EU, a policy officially supported by the Conservative Party. The government told the inquiry that immigration had boosted Britain's economy by £6 billion in 2006, a claim dismissed by peers as irrelevant and misleading. The EU is being urged to close a loophole that allows the exploitation of US agricultural subsidies for biofuels. The scam involves shipping biodiesel from Europe to the US and back again, allowing traders to claim 11p a litre of US subsidy for the entire cargo. More on this coming up in Guardian Daily. Courts in England and Wales are seriously overstretched, according to the Lord Chief Justice Lord Phillips in his annual review of the courts. His report contains implicit criticism of the government, with the claim that the job of judges is made infinitely more complex by a stream of legislation. He also criticised delays in repairing court buildings. The head coach of England's football team, Fabio Capello, is to be investigated for allegedly withholding evidence in a trial linked to Italy's 2006 match-fixing scandal. The England boss gave evidence yesterday in the trial of six men accused of promoting unfair competition. An angry state prosecutor lambasted the coach for hiding behind "I don't remembers" and "I don't knows." Capello's lawyers said in a statement that they were confident the matter would soon be resolved. To the papers now, where plenty of space is given over to that Lord's report on the economic impact of migration. "Immigration, the great lies," thunders the Mail, and "We must cap immigration," says the Express. The Times splashes with news that the conspiracy theories surrounding the death of Princess Diana have been finally dismissed by the coroner in the six-month inquest. The princess's butler, Paul Burrell's, been branded a liar, according to The Telegraph. Readers are urged to proceed with caution through the inside of the papers today, many of them taking full advantage of April Fool's Day. The Times prints its top 10 list of historical hoaxes, while The Guardian's occasional writer, Avril de Poisson, reveals that Carla Bruni Sarkozy has been appointed to spearhead an initiative aimed at injecting more style and glamour into British national life. The Sun also has the sensational news that pint-sized President Sarkozy is to be stretched in pioneering surgery to bring his height into line with his glamorous wife. The operation is to take place at the Poisson d'Avril Centre in Geneva, it chortles. The back pages focus on build-up to tonight's Champions League quarter-final between Manchester United and Roma, and there's plenty too about Fabio Capello. More news throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
It's hoped it'll save the environment. made from plants. We've been told that biofuels are the way of the future. But despite a growing industry to meet the demand, it doesn't seem to be a level playing field, with US producers being heavily subsidised. This has led their European counterparts to find other ways to make a profit, one of which is the so-called splash and dash scam. The Guardian's business editor, Deborah Hargreaves, tells us more.
Well, the Americans are producing quite a lot of biodiesel at the moment, and that's because they get quite big subsidies for it. The US government has got a long history of helping out its own farmers, and this is another way for farmers to make money. It's obviously very controversial because there is a there's obviously an argument that says food prices are going up because everyone's growing biofuels instead.
But the Americans are being subsidised, so it's very difficult for European biodiesel or biofuel companies to compete.
That's right. The Americans are getting 11p a litre subsidy on any of the biodiesel they produce. So that's being shipped across to Europe and being sold to undercut European producers. The European producers want to take a case to the World Trade Organization and complain about that. And they're urging the EU to do something about that. Obviously, this latest scam shows that European companies are fighting back themselves because they're actually shipping their fuel over to America, qualifying for the subsidy by adding a little drop of American fuel in and shipping it back across the Atlantic and selling it again in Europe.
So you couldn't really blame the European companies for doing this because they're competing with their backs to the wall against the Americans, aren't they?
Obviously, it's against the spirit of environmentalism if you're shipping your fuel across the Atlantic and back needlessly. There's nothing illegal about it, and you make quite a big profit out of doing it, but it's not really in the spirit of green fuels, is it?
But the whole biofuels market at the moment, is it sort of hanging in the balance because of events like this and the Europeans not making a profit, as you say?
Yeah, it's quite hard for the European industry. There seems to be some plants which aren't working in Germany because they can't make any money out of them. And there's a UK company which is looking at shelving some of its production facilities because it can't compete with subsidised American fuel.
And where do you think this will need some sort of government intervention?
Well, there is a strong push for biofuels to be used more and more in Europe. The UK on April the 15th, that's only 2 weeks, is coming out with its renewable fuels transport obligation, which means that all companies will have to add 2.5% of biofuel to any petrol they sell. So there is a huge drive for it. It's not being produced in Europe.
And that's what I mean about there may be the drive, but there'll need to be some sort of action taken to stop the scams and, of course, make sure that companies can make a profit and therefore the whole thing will roll on, which is what they want to do.
Well, the producers obviously want the EU to complain about it in the World Trading Organization and try and take some action against the Americans. But of course, at the same time, the green campaigners are saying biofuels aren't the right way to go because all they're doing is pushing up food prices and destroying places like the rainforest so that you can grow more biofuels.
Deborah Hargreaves, The Guardian's business editor. Elsewhere on our website today, there's the latest from the Diana inquest as the coroner continues his summing up. Lord Justice Scott Baker has already ruled out conspiracy theories. That's at guardian.co.uk/UK. Find out why the government's deciding to scrap vocational A-levels. That's at educationguardian.co.uk. And have a look at some pictures as they dig up Stonehenge. It's the first excavation there for 40 years. Plus, at guardian.co.uk/America, we reveal how Hillary Clinton's annoying her own staff. Now, the longer the delay, the more likely the dirty tricks. That's the collective view of observers of Saturday's presidential and parliamentary elections in Zimbabwe. The Election Commission began releasing just a trickle of results yesterday. They show an equal number of seats in the lower house of parliament being won by the ruling ZANU-PF party and the Movement for Democratic Change. The MDC's own table of results showed them winning both houses of parliament and 60% of the presidential vote for their candidate Morgan Tsvangirai. He's the MDC's Secretary General.
We're not going to go to court on this one. Our court are Zimbabweans. Our court are our brothers in Africa, our friends in the international community. We cannot go to a bench that is loaded, that is subjective. And we will not waste our time as we did. The presidential petition of 2002 is still waiting 6 years down the line. And we are not going to make that mistake again.
The Guardian is one of the few Western news organisations to have a reporter in Zimbabwe. Chris McGreal is in the capital, Harare. He says the opposition think the slow release of information is to give more time for the count to be rigged in favour of President Robert Mugabe.
It's not clear at all from these early results, partly because the constituencies have changed in this country, whether there has been fundamental manipulation. But as many more results come out, we'll have a clearer idea. If, of course, the vote is being manipulated, it will be quite clear. This is not just tinkering with a few numbers. Whole constituencies' outcomes are going to have to be reversed.
In previous elections, the presidential election results have come out earlier. So what reason is the Electoral Commission giving for this delay?
Well, they say this election is complicated, to use their phraseology, in part because it is more than one election. It now involves the two houses of parliament and the presidential election, whereas in years past, those things used to be separate. That has the opposition saying, well, how is it that we as the opposition and the independent monitors are able to collate results which are being posted publicly on polling station by polling station and come up with these figures that they say are provable and very accurate, and the official Electoral Commission is unable to release any figures at all more than 36 hours. And of course, that only feeds the suspicion, which would seem to be well grounded, that that the Electoral Commission is either going to interfere with the figures or had been told to delay the results for political reasons.
Now, there are some foreign election monitors there in Zimbabwe. What are they saying about this?
Well, the Pan-African Union has expressed great concern over the pace of the release of the results by the Electoral Commission. Most of the independent or international monitors are holding off on a verdict until they see what these results are. The Southern African Development Community issued a statement last night, which was its verdict on the election, saying that it looked free and fair, but that was based solely on the actions of polling day, and they haven't bothered to wait around to see what the results of the elections are. So that, to be honest, is not being treated as a very serious judgment on the election.
Mugabe's been in power for 28 years. He's thought of fixed elections before, at least one. How likely is it that he'll concede?
Well, I think the general feeling in Zimbabwe is it's very unlikely. These delays have reinforced the perception that he's unlikely to concede. There was a meeting last night of the Joint Operations Command, which is essentially his military cabinet. They discussed the various options, apparently, according to the sources we've been listening to. And it seems that there was a fair determination on the part of both the party and the upper echelons of the ruling ZANU-PF not to just give in, to find a way around what they regard as just a political problem.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
We're confronted by huge barriers at every level of society. That's the collective view of Britain's gay community, according to a new study. Stonewall, the equality charity which commissioned the poll, says it's the first authoritative poll representing 3.6 million people in Britain. Nearly one in five say they are bullied at work because of their sexual orientation, whilst an even greater number think they'd be treated less fairly by the police if they reported being the victim of a hate crime. Ruth Hunt is head of policy and research at Stonewall. She explained to The Guardian why it's taken so long for such an opinion poll to be compiled.
What seems to be the picture from everything from reporting a crime to wanting to enrolling a child in school, accessing housing or healthcare, is that gay people expect to be discriminated against. And what's really important about that is that we think that will inevitably affect how people make decisions about how they access services. If you're concerned about how you're going to be treated if people knew about your sexual orientation, you're going to go to certain lengths either to avoid being exposed to those situations or talking about your sexual orientation and being open about it. So it's a very worrying picture for us, we think. It's not enough, clearly, from this research to say we will not discriminate. you actually have to tell gay people quite explicitly and proactively that you won't discriminate in order to encourage them to come and access your services that they pay for with taxpayers' money.
Now, in terms of bullying, you broke it down into three age groups. We had the over 55s, the 34 to 45s, and the under 19s. And I found it very surprising that it was the under 19s where they found the biggest problem.
We were surprised by that too. I mean, what's clear is that homophobic bullying has gone up over the last 50 years, and that seeing homophobic bullying has also gone up. And of course, we've done another report called the School Report, where we interviewed over 1,000 young gay people about their experiences. And homophobic bullying is certainly rife in schools these days, but the situation seems to be getting worse, not better.
What do you put that down to? That seems incredible. I mean, only last year, it was 40 years since the law was changed when homosexuality became legal in Britain. But we seem to be going backwards, not forwards.
Well, I think there's several issues going on. First of all, kids know a lot more about gay stuff than they did in the olden days. So when I was young, when I was 16, 10 years ago, the word gay wasn't really used very much. People didn't know what gay meant. So although there was low levels of bullying, it wasn't quite as explicit. The second issue is that as that awareness has increased, gay kids know about gay stuff now. The schools haven't responded by knowing how to tackle homophobic bullying. And of course, Section 28 stops schools talking about it at all. And that legacy has left a massive impact on schools, with schools being very nervous about how to address the issue and how to support gay pupils. It is an area of great concern. It's one of Stonewall's biggest campaigns is trying to prevent and respond to homophobic bullying in schools.
So as you say, schoolyards emerged as one of the most entrenched bastions of homophobic prejudice, as you put it in the report. What other areas of society or organisations would you say are still some of these bastions?
There's several interesting things that come out, but one of the things that we're most interested in is this, that in politics, nearly 9 in 10 lesbian and gay people think they'd face barriers from the Conservative Party, for example, if they wanted to be selected to run for Parliament. And even if they support the Conservative Party, 7 in 10 of those people think they'd face barriers. And 3 in 5 would face barriers from the Labour Party, think they'd face barriers. So that's really indicative. You know, we're in a situation where we've only got one openly lesbian MP in the Commons. There's a real anxiety that their sexuality will be used against them if they ever wanted to run for Parliament. And that means that gay people are excluded from those democratic processes.
That's Ruth Hunt of Stonewall. I'm Tony Adams, and still to come on Guardian Daily, why juries should be thrown out of rape trials, plus the celebrity described as everything from telly wallpaper to a washed-up game show host.
That does actually follow me literally everywhere. You know, still down the street, it's like everybody gets game show Tourette's when they're around me.
But first, any further cuts to the number of British troops in Basra are expected to be put on hold following violent scenes in the city last week. Although a ceasefire was ordered on Sunday by the leader of Iraq's Mahdi Army Shia militia, Defence Secretary Des Brown is unlikely to mention any reduction in troop numbers when he makes a statement to the Commons today. Ewan McCaskill is The Guardian's Washington correspondent. He says even though British troop numbers are to remain the same for now, it's not going to be particularly good news for our American allies.
They're more or less sort of reconciled now to, you know, minimum British involvement. But there was huge disappointment. There was a big disappointment last year when Brown told Bush that they were going to pull out of the centre of Basra and have a gradual reduction. Because it creates huge problems for the Americans. They're overstretched. Although they've got 154,000 troops, that sounds like a lot. But the number who are engaged is quite small. And they're heavily engaged in Baghdad, Anbar province, Mosul. They don't need to have to send, you know, another big detachment south to deal with Basra. And there's a real danger of that.
And what are America's options as regards the south and Basra?
Well, it's crucial for the Americans because the main supply line is from Kuwait, you know, through Basra up to Baghdad. So they've got to secure those supply lines. But it's also strategic. And they were hoping that the Iraqi forces themselves would be capable of pacifying or at least keeping things under control in Basra. And that doesn't look as if it's happening.
And you can hear more from Ewan, including who he predicts will win the presidential election, in this week's Guardian Weekly podcast. That's ready to download on Wednesday. Is it important for a jury to know about a woman's sexual history when she claims she's been raped? Many judges in Britain appear to think that it is, even though there's now supposed to be severe limits on such questioning following new legislation in 2000. A new book says that the myths and stereotypes about the crime of rape go a long way to explaining a conviction rate of just 5.7%. The book is called Sexual Assault and the Justice Gap, A Question of Attitude. It's co-written by Jennifer Temkin, a professor of law at Sussex University.
When we talk about myths and stereotypes, we're talking about the kind of negative attitudes towards women who complain of rape. You know, there are people who believe, for example, that true rapes are only ever carried out by strangers, and that where rape accusations are made against men who are known to some extent by the victim, then that really isn't true rape. And, you know, there are attitudes and views that if a woman has a past sexual history, or if she was drunk at the time, or if she was wearing revealing clothes, well, then that really isn't a rape at all, even if she did express the fact that she didn't consent. There are views also about how real, genuine rape victims should behave during a rape or after a rape. There's a view that, you know, if a person is a genuine rape victim, then when she mentions the rape to somebody, she will be tearful, she will be hysterical, and if she isn't either of those things, then she can't be a real rape victim. There are all sorts of false beliefs and mythologies surrounding rape, and I'm afraid that these do stand in the way of obtaining justice for women who complain of rape and who are totally genuine.
There's one judge that told us that basically it's a big issue for judges, the ability to be able to ask questions about a woman's past sexual behaviour. It's still a very big issue for judges.
It is the case that judges do tend to like to have legislation which gives them discretion. They like to be able to, as it were, be in the driving seat when it comes to evidence, and they like to have a discretion. Now, the 1999 Act does not give them discretion. It is actually a very balanced legislation. It's not, it doesn't rule out sexual history evidence altogether by any manner of means, and allows lots of opportunities, in fact, to include it. But it doesn't really give a discretion to the judges, and I think that a lot of them have a problem with that.
Are judges a problem then? Are they still stuck in their views, would you say, from what you found out researching this book?
I think many of the judges are actually very good, and it may well be that if we had judges dealing with rape trials rather than juries, we might very well have higher conviction rates. Now, I can't say that for sure, because that wasn't something that we were able to measure. But it's certainly true that juries do present a bit of a problem as far as gaining convictions are concerned. But on the other hand, I think it is also true that judges have been somewhat resistant to some of the legislation, and it is to be hoped that this can be rectified through more education of the judges on these matters.
The Guardian Football Weekly Podcast with James Richardson.
As they say at Terminal 5, we've got bags to get through in today's Football Weekly. There's the Premier League with United on fire, Arsenal back in business and Newcastle living the dream. There's Liverpool winning the derby, but with more boardroom malaise than FC Kuala Lumpur. There's the exciting news from Wembley with MK Dons victorious and Paul Ince on the blur to share his joy. From Italy, there's a preview of Roma's chances against Manchester United, and there's tragic news as yet another fan dies in a motorway service station incident. There's Sidlow on the blur from Spain, and a little look at what happened in the first weekend of the new MLS season in the States. That's all in Football Weekly. For details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
He's chatted to chickens on live TV and split up with his younger, prettier wife in the full glare of the tabloids. Now, Les Dennis has written his autobiography. It's called Must the Show Go On? It even details how he wet himself before his rehearsal for the TV show Extras. He's been speaking to Patrick Barkham about his snobbery, misery and cowardice.
Tell us, Les, why did you write your autobiography?
I thought it was time to. It's a life lived, 54 years, and there's plenty packed in there to tell the story of. And I was ready with the distance of time from some of the darker times to be able to look back properly.
And you actually wrote it yourself, which is quite unusual. Most people think celebrities can't write.
I did write it myself, and maybe people are still going to tell me celebrities can't write. It's because it's not out yet, so I hope that it's okay. And I loved the experience of it. Yeah, I didn't want a ghostwriter. I wanted it to be my voice. And when I read a book, even if a ghostwriter is really good and captures something, there's something just missing. So I wanted it to be my voice.
And what's your favourite story from the book? Because there's lots of great anecdotes.
I love the one of Tommy Cooper being on stage doing an auction, and it was actually my uncle. He was asking the people, "What will you give me for this toaster?" In a Tommy Cooper way, so what will you give me for this toaster? And my uncle shouted, "Two slices of bread," and Tommy went, "That's funny. I like that." It was watching Tommy Cooper, even the great Tommy Cooper, being heckled. So I loved that story.
You mentioned about the sort of dark times that you chronicle. What was the sort of lowest moment, or what was the hardest passage of your life to write about?
I think actually the people might think that it would be my marriage breakup, but I think probably the hardest thing was chronicling the deaths of my parents. Particularly my mum, who died of cancer in 1977. And dealing with those things, actually writing it down was quite tough.
I mean, it's a very honest book. Is there anyone that you've slagged off that you kind of think, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that?
Do you think I've slagged some people off? You've read it. You know what? I've tried to be honest and I've tried to be fair. And, you know, sometimes you do have to tell things as they were. But it's always your story and your side of that story. And equally, if I would upset somebody, I'd be devastated, I think. But you know, I've got to tell it. I've got to tell it how it was, and I hope I've balanced anything that is tough for somebody.
What's your favourite sort of catchphrase or phrase or joke that you've uttered during your career?
Well, I suppose I like that that I got a catchphrase by accident, which is, if it's up there, I'll give you the money myself, which came from Family Fortunes. And I liked that there were a couple of times where I actually did have to pay that money to the people when they gave such ridiculously stupid answers, but that the survey agreed with them and they were up there. I did think that was a possible title for the book at one time. It was John Culshaw who suggested, I'll give you the story myself, which was a good title, but we went with Must the Show Go On in the end.
Would you be a great sport and give us the noise that follows you everywhere? I just want to hear it from your own lips.
From my want the that does actually follow me literally everywhere. You know, still down the street, it's like everybody gets game show Tourette's when they're around me.
Les Dennis talking to Patrick Barkham there. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Just to finish off on one of your emails from Epson Egan in Geneva. He says, thanks for a great show. I listen every day. Keep up the good work. And you can get in touch, tell us what you think by emailing guardian.daily@guardian.co.uk. The producers today were Andy Duckworth, Phil Maynard, James Webster, and I'm Tony Adams. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.